And I was like, when will I rot?
But the rotting.
Don't they know? I have to rot.
How else will I become nutritious compost?
I mean, truly, I have big compost dreams.
I thought you were going to say I have big compost vibes.
Big compost energy.
I am giving back to the soil.
There it is. There it is. I'm reclaiming my nutritious state for other organic beings.
I'm upcycling myself.
Perfect. The year of upcycling my human form.
Books. Books. Books.
Books. Hello and welcome to Didn't Read It, the podcast that may or may not have an Instagram presence by the time this comes out.
Oh no.
I am your host, Grace Todd, writer, editor, book gremlin, unsuccessful user of Instagram support.
Wow, wow.
And with me today is new friend of the pod, Maddie Wood.
Hello.
Hi, Maddie.
Hello. I'm very excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Maddie. I am a marketing professional who loves books. This was my first foray back into a classic after like a real heavy time with some just like rom-coms. We're just rom-comming every moment of the day.
They were romming and comming.
We were comming. We were romming. We were rom-roms. We were com-coms.
Were we comming for our roms?
We were comming for our roms. They're coming for them. Holy shit. That's, you know, I love to read. I've always been a big reader. I also have a very useless history degree that has no relevance in my life, but is going to have a lot of relevance to our podcast today. So I'm very excited to talk about The Lost Cause, which is something that everyone says on a Friday evening that they cannot wait to talk about The Lost Cause, but I'm actually very excited. So,
well, would that not in fact then make the history degree useful? You are using it right now.
You're very right. I should say professionally. I mean, have no use for it in a money-making capitalist way.
I mean, it's very hard to have anything be useful in a money-making capitalist way except rich parents and not having a soul.
Well, I unfortunately have one of those things.
Which one?
Let's titillate them by letting them guess.
Fair enough.
No soul over here, guys. High five.
Hashtag no soul.
We love to see it.
Well, Maddie, today I was minding my own business in this beautiful space where I record, and you kicked the door in and you made eye contact with me, and you did the thing where you pointed at your eyeballs and pointed at my eyeballs and then pointed at your eyeballs again, and you said, "I'm the captain now," and then you threw a book at my head.
That is exactly how I remember it happening. In my mind and our friendship, you are Tom Hanks. So this is very fitting that this is the way that I actually enter all rooms. This is how I enter rooms. I have a big presence. And I hurled a copy of William Faulkner's The Unvanquished, which, friends, not his most popular. But I'm very excited to just like lead you into like a really bummer time. And like paragraph long sentences. Are you titillated yet?
I was not familiar with this work until it came into contact with my skull.
Right, when I knocked you in the noggin.
And when I got myself up off the floor.
Which I did not help with.
No, absolutely not. You just watched me struggle.
Again, big presence.
And in my best Tom Hanks voice, I said, "This looks interesting." And then we sat down to record, so.
Yeah, this is a blow-by-blow of exactly how I remember this interaction going. So this is great. So for those unfamiliar with William Faulkner, he's a Southerner, very famous novelist, maybe one of the most famous novelists to come out of the great state of Mississippi. This book started as a series of short stories that were published in the Saturday Evening Post, except for the final chapter, the final story. And they start in 1863. First story is in 1863. But it follows a young man and his enslaved friend. I always assumed potential half-brother. They're like months apart. They're very close. And so Bayard is the white little boy's name and Ringo is the enslaved boy's name. And it sort of follows them throughout. So first we're going to start. We'll start at the beginning where all good stories start. Pretend that I have like a pencil thin mustache.
I will.
Because William Faulkner had an amazing little mustache. Behind the smokehouse that summer, Ringo and I had a living map. Although Vicksburg was just a handful of chips from the woodpile and the river a trench scraped into the packed earth with the point of a hoe, it, river, city, and terrain, lived, possessing even in miniature that ponderable, though passive, recalcitrance of topography which outweighs artillery, against which the most brilliant of victories and the most tragic of defeats are but the loud noises of a moment.
Wow,
we really turn a phrase.
Yeah.
It starts with them playing in the woods.
Great.
As all small boys do. Reenacting what they think is currently happening in Vicksburg, which is a city on the Mississippi River in, was a big on-again, off-again push to take Vicksburg, the siege of Vicksburg.
Right, because just... we are in the middle of the Civil War.
Yes, I'm so sorry. Not everyone has lived, breathed, and died the Civil War like I have.
Not everyone hears 1863 and is like, ah, yes, I remember which offenses were happening and who was trying to take Vicksburg at the time.
I am titillated to know that Pemberton is trying to take Vicksburg. Yes, we are in the midst of the American Civil War for our also international listeners. I assume there's many.
So many. We're very popular in Iceland. That's a lie. No, but I hope we are.
I think that people in Reykjavik are just like, please, more American Civil War content. And I'm here to give it to them. I'm here.
We give the people what we want. Exactly. What they want. At Didn't Read It.
I mean, everyone was like, why haven't you done a not well-known William Faulkner book yet? Here we are. Today's episode. So... Bayard and Ringo are playing in the woods and they have like built this like little dirt fort and they are playing war, which I've always found this very striking because the Civil War is obviously like looms so large in American history, but also you forget that people were just like hanging out at home.
Just living their lives.
Just living their lives and also like excited. We think of it as such like a dark and depressing time. But this is like lots of home front. It's very little on the battle side and all on this like home front side. It's very interesting in that way because it's not something that you really think about that often. So they're playing and one of the other enslaved folks comes up and lets them know Vicksburg's fallen. Like, don't worry about this. And he like wipes their dirt fort.
Oh.
And this like strikes Bayard because he's like, how could he know? How could he know something I don't know?
Oh.
And how could he have news of this? So then we learn that Bayard's dad is fighting. And they live on a plantation. They are a very well-to-do, well-known family. And he is off fighting. John is his name. And
I assume on the behalf of the Confederacy.
You would assume correctly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay.
One of the first people to raid a regiment in their area. He is a devoted Confederate.
So not just fighting on the behalf of the Confederacy, but
yes,
just came out of the gates
gunslinging.
Cool.
Was like, let me defend pure white virginal womanhood.
My honor.
Yes. So much honor. So, so much honor to be defended. So suddenly dad comes home.
Uh-oh.
And he's like, I am just here for a min. Just gonna like pop in, and while I'm here, let's take all of the silver and bury it.
Oh. Things are going super duper well.
I mean, it is giving like winning vibes when you want to come home mid battle to bury all of your silver in the backyard.
I was busy shooting Union soldiers in the head, so many of them. They were just falling right and left. There were angels on the battlefield fighting next to me on my behalf, and I just suddenly thought, that the silver would really benefit from a vacation in an unmarked hole in the yard.
I mean, it's almost like you were there. I just got chills. Were you there?
I mean, I'm everywhere at all times.
I'm very upset at your omniscience and jealous. I'm very upset and jealous. The other adult in the household is Bayard's grandma, hereafter referred to just as Granny, who seems, I don't know, she's one of those people that you're like, I'm not supposed to like you, but I sort of like you.
Maggie Smith and Downton Abbey vibes.
Kind of, but like in a way where you're like, you own slaves.
Sure, yeah.
So there's just like a bit of, there's just like, oh, I don't know about, Granny. Mm. Bayard and Ringo, who's the enslaved boy, overhear John, the dad, telling Granny that Vicksburg has fallen. So now they've gotten confirmation that this enslaved person knew something that they didn't. Again, very upsetting to them. So they decide that they need to keep watch on this other enslaved person. His name's Louche. And is like, we need to watch him because, like, obviously something's up.
Oh.
So they go out on watch. They steal their dad's musket. And they are watching and they see a single Yankee soldier come through the field. They take a shot.
Uh-oh.
Through some, like, will of God, they make the shot. But they shoot the horse. They shoot the horse out from under the soldier. And they're running. They're like, oh, crap. I have really done a thing and Granny is going to be pissed. And they're right. They run inside and hide. And by hide, I mean they get under Granny's skirts. Because they have just killed a Yankee soldier in their front yard.
Well, they've killed his horse.
They've killed a Yankee soldier's horse also, in their front yard.
Very quick. And this is just for my friend Danica, but oh sure, take it out on the poor horse, why don't you?
I mean, truly, like, we could have taken those monuments and just cut the bodies off of them. Those horses didn't do anything.
The horses did nothing wrong.
Union sergeant comes in and is like, hey, a errant gunshot just came from your property and we just had to shoot our best horse. We were going to race him and there was a lot of money riding on it.
Uh-oh.
And Granny's like, I don't know what you're talking about. There are no children that live here. Don't mind me. Didn't happen. And the sergeant is like, no way. We're going to search the property. And then his superior comes in and is like, must have been an errant shot. He's very aware that there obviously are children hiding under Granny's skirts. But he's choosing to be like the gentleman. Like, oh, we're the... I'm the high road gentleman.
Sure.
And is like, well, don't let any other wink, wink, errant shots kill my horses.
And also, like, what are you going to do? Like, try a 8-year-old for war crimes?
Correct. And this also does confirm to the boys that they only killed the horse because they initially, like, the rider falls because the horse falls. And they're like, we are murderers. We're hiding under our grandmother's skirts and we have murdered a Yankee. They hide the silver. The next year, there's lots of weird time jumps in this book.
Mm-hmm.
It is because it was like all these separate stories. They're all the same characters and it is linear, but there are like large time jumps that just like don't really get.
You just have to intuit
them
from context.
You're just
like,
okay, yeah. Time has passed. Cool. John, the dad, Colonel Sartoris, comes back and says, dig that silver up. Take it to Memphis. It'll be safe there.
Sure. Yep.
That seems like a great trip for a grandmother and two like 10-year-old boys to make in war-ravaged Mississippi in like 1864. But that silver, man, it's important as hell.
Clearly.
They dig up the chest. They put it into a wagon. It is very heavy. They have to go through like Union-occupied areas as they tootle with Granny with a parasol. There was a lot of like, we're taking turns with Granny and the parasol. Who gets to sleep in the wagon? Who gets to hold the parasol?
I'm just a little old lady with a parasol and definitely not a trunk full of silver.
Definitely not. They are pulling their wagon. They're in Union occupied territory. They come upon some soldiers. Soldiers take the silver and the mules that are pulling their wagon.
That was fast.
Well, I mean, what did you expect a little bit? Like,
seems like you could have just left it in the yard and it would have been fine.
I also thought that. But who am I? not a Confederate soldier, not in 1864, and not living in Mississippi, so, and not a man.
I mean, all the silver buried in my backyard has been fine, despite the roving bands of invaders, so.
I mean, I don't disagree with you, and I hope to find someone else's silver in my yard one day.
You get away from my yard and my silver.
I would never. Never. I would never. Bayard and Ringo go off, leave Granny in the wagon with no mule, steal a horse. They're riding their horses and they overcome the people, the like soldiers who took their stuff. Granny gets home safely.
Somehow.
Somehow. But interestingly enough, a Union brigade rides by the house looking for their dad the next day and they burn the house. And so chests of silver gone, house is burned. Their dad is like on the run. There's a war, like not a warrant, but like they're looking for him.
The Union is trying to find him.
Yes. Granny is pissed.
Uh-huh.
She's like, that silver is mine. As were those mules. And you gentlemen didn't ask nicely. You took them from me. And then you burned my house down.
Uh-huh.
So she's like, I'm going to go. And who's going to like say no to a little old lady?
Lots of people, actually.
Actually, yeah. Like me, all the time. Like, get out of here. She's like, no one's gonna, like, say anything to me. So I'll take the two boys, and I will go personally, like, petition to get our stuff back.
Okay. And how? And so the boys are still, like, 10-ish?
Yeah, we're, like, in the 10, 11 range right now. Once again, we're in the wagon. We're heading to Alabama. That's where the army is. They are on their way. They are starting to encounter more and more, like, enslaved people who are trying to get to Union lines, because if they reach Union lines, depending on, you know, this is like changes throughout the war, but if they could get to Union lines, they could get taken as like contraband, as move with the Union army. So right. It's basically like freedom, not really, but this is like the whole conundrum of the Emancipation Proclamation.
It's freedom enough anyway.
Yes, correct.
More freedom than they have currently.
Yes to all of the above. On their way, they're going to stop at, like, their cousin's house. And they're, like, very excited to get there. They have a railroad next to their house. And Ringo is, like, very excited. I'm going to see a railroad.
Oh.
And he's never seen a railroad.
I guess you wouldn't, living in rural Mississippi.
Correct. So they get there, and the house is no more. And the Union has pulled up the railroad and done what they did a lot, which was, they would heat up the actual, like, rail ties and, like, twist them or wrap them around trees so that they couldn't rebuild them. So the railroad's gone, and he is bummed. Because small boys love trains.
Small boys do love a train.
Thomas or not, they are loving a tank engine. And there is a tank engine no more.
I'm getting the vibe that we're getting a lot of contrast between sort of childish joys and disappointments stretched across the landscape of an active and very dangerous conflict that these little boys maybe don't have the capacity to fully grasp the seriousness of? Or
yes, it's like they do and they don't. They're 10, 11-ish, but it's 1864, which means they were 6, 7 when the war started. So this is also like your reality of memory at that point in your life.
Right.
But yes, this is also a book where there's like, there is plot that like does slowly move it forward, but it's also just kind of a lot of talking. It's a lot of scenery setting. It's a lot of just sort of commentary for commentary sake. Yeah. And not as much like plot. So it all gets sort of like interwoven with that. But they get to their cousin's house, and now we're going to meet what I think is maybe one of the more interesting female characters written in this time. So this book was written in 1938, but the stories were published like over a period of time before that, and then the very last chapter didn't get published until he published it as a full book. And we're gonna meet Bayard's cousin Drusilla, who,
hell of a name,
it's just like fantastic. Immediately you're like, are you like a Cruella de Vil type?
Ooh.
Vibe. That's like the vibe I've always gotten. Or like one of Cinderella's terrible stepsisters. In fact, no, she is like this incredible like tomboy.
Oh.
Of the time. They arrive, their house is burned down, and Drusilla has rowed up to the river which is where the Union forces are. And there's a bridge, and they're trying to get all the Union forces over the bridge. And there's all these, like, enslaved people that are trying to get to the Union lines. And the Union, in reality, doesn't really want them. Even people in the North were not, like, most people were not like, hell yeah. They were just like, this is what we have to do. But it was not because so many people were so pro-abolition.
Right. A lot of them were still hella racist.
Hella racist. And it was like, it's 1864. War has been ravaging for 4 years, or 3 years at this point. So sorry.
How dare you?
I know. And so those are also all like additional mouths to feed for these moving armies that do not have consistent like food sources unless they are basically like stealing as they go along or taking from the land. And so the Union army, as he tells it, there's a bridge crossing the river, and as soon as they get all the Union troops over the river, they're going to blow the bridge up.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Meanwhile, as they had been walking, there's all these enslaved people that are trying to reach the river and are calling it the River Jordan because it's like how they're going to get their freedom.
Oh, no.
So we've set quite a scene of like, oh no.
This seems bad, actually.
This is going to go poorly. Foreshadowing. So they get to their cousin's house. Drusilla comes back and is like, I've been down there. They're going to blow up the bridge. But like, that's where the army is. So like, that's where you guys need to go if you want their stuff back. And then she's standing there in the middle of the night with Bayard, and they're watching these just like waves of people like pass by. And she says to him, would you tell your dad I'd like to go fight with him?
Okay.
Which again, for like a female character, not that there were not women that fought during the Civil War, because there definitely were.
Sure.
But this was such like an interesting character for him to put in here. Because very at conflict with this idea, and this they get way more into this, with this idea of pure honorable Southern white womanhood, which is part of like what you're supposed to be fighting for. And she like rides a horse, not side saddle, and she like wears pants, and like she's this very sort of interesting, weirdly progressive character in the midst of this whole scene.
That's interesting, because she wants to go fight with his dad on the behalf of the Confederacy, which
correct.
Seems like a vision of society that would do everything it could to make sure that she could not do any of those things you just said.
So
the trousers and the horseback riding.
Correct.
And pretty much anything except fainting like Scarlett O'Hara whenever she's slightly startled.
So part of her backstory is also that she was engaged.
Ooh.
And her beau is killed pretty early in the war. So some of it is this idea of deep-rooted like revenge.
Okay.
Which like perpetuates throughout the book. But that's part of it. Her dad at this point has also died during the war. So like that plays into part of her story, and I think more informs the like Confederate piece of it.
Sure.
And also just like a homeland, like this is like the way I've always lived, and this is, I guess, what I love, even though it hates me. Who's to know?
I mean, she wouldn't be the first white woman to actively advocate against her own self-interest.
No, I actually, I don't want to make this all about today or anything, but kind of got a problem with that currently.
No, I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know. Don't be silly.
No.
No. So they wake up the next morning. Bayard, Ringo, and Granny get in the wagon and start moving towards the river. And the surge of people is like so strong that they get caught up. They're like floating almost on a sea of people.
Oh, wow.
And then the Union blows up the bridge.
Oh, God.
I love this because they're obviously like, Granny's there. Her and her parasol are like trying to beat people off around them because they're like being like lifted on the ground, and then all of a sudden they're in the water. And it says, we sprinkled water on Granny until she came to. The idea of them, these like two little boys and this like tiny old grandma in a like wagon with like drowned horses. I was just like, this is such a picture, William Faulkner. You're really doing it. They get her out of the water. They get out of the water. Their horses have drowned. The wagon's like gone. And now they're in the Union encampment on the other side of the river. Because they're white, and so they cared to pull them out of the river.
Sure. Well, obviously. A bunch of people drown right and left.
Yes. Yes. Then they meet Colonel Dick. And I am choosing to believe that William Faulkner did this on purpose. Because interestingly enough, Colonel Dick is not a dick. Turns out Colonel Dick is the man who, wink, wink, was already at their house earlier when they shot the horse out from under him.
Oh, we already like him.
Yes. And so they sort of recognize him and is like, I'm going to help you get back your silver and your mules. And then he does this wild thing where he writes them this note. And it says, to all brigade, regimental, and other commanders, you will see that bearer is repossessed in full of the following property, to wit, 10 chests tied with hemp rope and containing silver, 110 mules captured loose near Philadelphia in Mississippi, 110 Negroes of both sexes belonging to and having strayed from the same locality. You will further see that bearer is supplied with the necessary food and forage to expedite his passage to his destination by order of the general commanding. And so Colonel Dick takes this moment to be like, I have too much stuff.
Ooh. What?
Yeah.
I don't.
A very wild move, but also in his mind, I'm like, okay, you've got this army. You're probably really low on food. You don't really need the silver. And it's heavy as shit.
Sure.
You don't really need all these, like, former enslaved people, enslaved folks, like, to feed. And you probably don't need all the mules that you have been taking everywhere. Any place you go, you just take all their livestock. So he writes this note, and he signs it. So they go, and they get all the things that are on the list. And Granny feels, like, very odd about this because she is a godly woman, and this is lying. Even though that's what the note says, and Ringo keeps telling her, we're just doing what the note says. Like, this is what he wrote. Like, it's not a lie. She was like, yeah, but this isn't what we came for. We had, like, one chest of silver. No, like, human.
No humans.
No human yeah. people. And we, like, had, like, 10 mules. And this is, like, 10 times everything that we, like, asked for.
What's the implication of, like, why? Isn't he just assisting the enemy at this point? I mean, they are.
Again, this is like trying to reinforce this like gentlemanly character of him. Mm. That he's like, this is this little old lady and these two young bucks, and I'm going to give them all the stuff that both also helps me because it's less stuff I have to move and take care of.
So, sure. Okay.
This note basically is like this like get out of jail free card for them to just roam on the way home, and like any Union troop that they meet and show has to give them anything that they have. And so what Granny does is they get a ways, and she tells all the enslaved people, like,
you can go. Yeah. Well, that's good.
And she feeds them.
Okay.
Then she gives, like, some of the mules, and so that every time they reach another group, they've let some of the mules go and picked up more. And so by the time they get home, they still have 110 mules, which is like a stupid amount of mules.
That's so many. How do you even...
What do you even do with 110 mules?
Throw, like, a mule party?
Mosh pit on top of them? Like, just bounce your human form on top of the backs of 110 mules lined up? I don't know.
I only sleep on beds made of live mules.
I mean, I have heard that it's really good for your back.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that they are
great
very
lumbar support.
Exactly. And very friendly, not bitey.
No.
Not cantankerous.
They smell great.
And yes, I actually have a candle at home called Mule.
Yeah, people compliment me all the time on my
mule like smell.
My mule perfume, as it were, that I get from my sleeping on the bed of mules.
My eau de mule. Just like a delight. And so they've got all these mules. The next section starts. We've, like, moved forward in time, not a ton. And we meet this new character, Ab. Ab Snopes.
What a name.
Truly. Ab Snopes was a friend of their dad's. Their dad's alive. But when he went off to war, he was like, keep watch. And so they think he's a person to be trusted.
But he's...
Bum, bum, bum. do not trust Ab Snopes. They have gotten with Ab, and they have worked out this, like, system where they are gaming the Union Army. they have all these mules. Here's the mules. We're back to mules. They have all these mules.
And we got all these mules, see?
I got a mule, see? I got a big old pen of mules. They take some of the mules, and we later find out that Granny has been giving them, renting them out to poor folks that, like, don't have any means for themselves. Like, she's being very, like, generous in the mules. She's a generous mule woman.
She's paying it forward on the mule front.
I mean, I wish I had someone paying me forward in the mule front. Anyway, so they'll, like, mule out some of the mules. And then what they'll do is, somewhere along the way, Ringo has managed to get a box of Union Army stationery. And we never learn where. He just goes out riding one night and comes home with it. They have perfected the handwriting of the original Union note that gets written to them.
Oh.
They write a note that basically says everything except it's just about the mules. That they are allowed to requisition mules. So they will go find a Union troop, show them the letter, get the mules. Then they will go get the mules taken away, and then they will give them to another Union troop. And so they just, like, are cycling mules between different Union troops while also still keeping some for themselves every time. So they've got, like, a herd of mules.
This is so many more mule logistics than I expected.
There's more. don't get... There's more. So we've reached this point where she's been, like, selling the mules back to the Union Army that they've already requisitioned from the Union Army, and then just doing this whole process over again. So she's making money. We've got mules. It's like this cycle. And
Laundering mules.
They are laundering mules, and Ab is the laundress, the launderer. And he's the one that, like, goes out and, like, does the dirty work for them. But he's, like, kind of sus. He's, like, a little bit of a sketchy dude. And Granny's like, I don't know. I feel like we've done it enough. I feel like we've really, like...
We're pushing our limits on mule laundering.
Right,
we are running out of detergent for our mule laundry.
Right, these mules are...
Made for walking.
They're getting, like, kind of crumpled. They've been through the wash a couple times. But Granny's like, I don't want to do this. I think that, like, we've done enough, and we've gotten, like, $500 plus out of this, and, like, it's 1864, and that's just, like, more money than, like... But Ab's like, we should do it this one more time. Do it this one more time. And she's like, ugh.
Snopes is leaning hard on the one last heist.
Yeah, Snopes is like, let's Ocean's 11 this.
And everyone's going to die.
Granny's like, I don't know. So they decide to do it one more time. They go to get the mules. They hand over the paper. They get not that far away before someone realizes it's a scam.
Uh-oh.
Starts to come for them.
Which is what always happens when always. You pull one last job.
Always. This is Andy Garcia is standing in his casino and it's like, the mules!
Surrounded by mules.
Just like a posse of mules. They run, they hide in the woods. And the Union comes and Granny is just like, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, plays the... just like senile granny card.
I've never seen a mule in my life.
What's a mule, you say? A beverage with ginger beer in this economy?
I've been drinking all day.
I don't know who you are. So Granny, quote, where are the mules? The officer shouted. What mules? Granny said. Who? Don't lie to me, the officer shouted. The mules you've just left camp with on that forged order. We've got you this time. We knew you'd turn up again. Orders went out to the whole department to watch for you a month ago. That damn Newberry had his copy in his pocket while you were talking to him. And then he, like, cusses out this other guy of being so stupid that he didn't even read his own mail. They also have this thing where they're giving her a fake name every time, and they're working through the alphabet. So they're on the P's. That's how often they've been doing this. They've gotten to the P's, and her name in this case is Plurella Harris, which is not a name.
That is not a real name.
And she's like, that's not my name. I'm on my way home. Like, what's your real name? Like, I don't know. Mules are off. They're mad.
She's like, there are...
They're fine.
Hundreds of old Southern ladies who look just like me.
Yes. I misdoubted this all the time, Granny said. Well, you didn't tell Snopes that. Is what I'm saying. they've lost this small set of mules, but they're all just like, it's fine because we still have 19 more mules. I said, quote, that makes 248. And not until I talked about it out loud did I realize how big of a role mules played. And I feel like I've never said this word as much as I've said it so far. It's starting to sound foreign.
I mean, that's a sizable mule racket they have going.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there's a world where that's very impressive. There's a world where Clint Eastwood would make a movie about her. About Plurella.
A handful of mules.
Yeah. Plurella's mules.
The good, the bad, and the mules.
I mean, all of these things.
The mule with no name.
Clint, if you're not taking notes, you're really wasting your time. Or you're talking to that chair.
Mule Torino.
Anyway, I reckon that completes that, Ringo said. Anyway, we handled 248 head while the business lasted. 246, Granny said. We have lost the team. Because they take the wagon.
Boo.
Still. So then we get this scene where we learn that Granny has been using the money and the mules to, like, help the larger community. Yeah. Which, like, very wisely softens you even more to Granny right before her ultimate demise.
Oh.
Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert from this book from 1938. Ruh-roh.
Granny's not going to make it.
So they get to church. They go to church. The next scene, they're in their church. No longer the stuffy Episcopalian church of their time. It's sort of this, like, hodgepodge, ragtag. Their preacher is, like, a former soldier. And so at the end of his service, she pulls out this giant book and everyone comes up to her one by one and she either gives them some money or she gives them a mule and is like, oh, Grans.
Oh, Grammy. Graham.
You've used the N-word a lot, but otherwise, it seems like you're doing the Lord's work. Yeah, spoiler alert also, or trigger warning, this book has a gratuitous use of the N-word. Very common of the time period. We don't love it. It was very hard to read. There is an interesting switch near the end that we'll get to, but he only uses the N-word when he's talking about them as enslaved people.
Oh.
Once they're free, they're Negroes.
Interesting.
So that's another, like, interesting sort of thing that you start to see, and Ringo even calls it out at a later point. It's not great. And again, it is very hard to just, like, casually read in bed at night and be like, whoa, that's a lot of race hate. But I guess that's what you get for reading a book from 1930.
A Mississippian novelist from the 1930s.
There it is.
It's brimming with racism. I'm shocked.
Wild, I know.
Well, that's one of the reasons didn't read it, is because sometimes it's useful to know about these books, but maybe you don't want to sit down and just bathe in gratuitous racial epithets.
So, next scene, they are at home, and a small band of Union troops come and want these mules. We're back on Mulegate, baby.
This is just a book about mules with some people sprinkled around it.
I'm gonna tell you that the unvanquished are the mules. No one's vanquishing these mules. They are perpetual. They are here. They are here to stay. He comes in and is like, I know you got these mules, babe. Babe, give me these mules.
Babe, where are the mules, babe?
Babe. Pookie, where are those mules? He's like, we're being told to pull out of the area. I should be the last federal soldier you ever see. But, like, give me the
rest of the mules.
Give me the good stuff. He breaks down the fence of the pen.
Oh, my God. She's a mule.
She's a mule. Mew, mew.
And with that, the rest of the mules are gone.
More or less.
And how old are the boys now?
Like 12.
Okay, they're still pretty... We've only traversed a short distance time-wise.
Correct.
Okay. And the Union Army is pulling out.
Correct.
All right.
Yes, it says, we're under orders to pay for all property damage in the process of evacuation. This is a voucher on the quartermaster of Memphis for $10 for the fence. He didn't give the paper to her at once. He just stood there looking at her. Confound it. I don't mean promise. If I just knew what you believed in, held. He cursed again, not loud and not at anybody or anything. And so he's basically like, whatever I give you a note for will come out of my pay, and like I'm poor, and like this is all I can afford. Like they're gonna come for me and my pay afterwards.
Oh no,
for the damage I've done. And he was like, are you gonna make my life terrible? And she's like, no.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, sure. So then she makes him go to the church and pray, because anytime there's like any like kind, she loves to pray. It happens a lot. Anytime they lie, anytime like something happens. So they go and they pray. And
you mean an old Southern granny in the 1860s is big into praying?
What?
I'm
aghast.
Shocked.
Aghast.
I've never heard something so controversial.
It is wild because, you know, Jesus really like supported everything they were doing.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They were doing this kind of like in his honor.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never been very appreciative of that.
If there's one thing I know about Jesus, it's that he was super pro oppression, just loved taking advantage of people, hurting people.
You get it.
Yeah.
He was very much like, screw your neighbor.
Yeah. He was the original. You, I got mine.
Do not listen to your parents.
No.
Like, do have sex with your neighbor's wife.
Yeah. Step, just like ruin the lives of the poor whenever possible.
Yeah. Kind of was like horny for that.
Yeah.
All right. Next scene. This little section starts with, quote, we tried to keep her from doing it. We both tried. Ringo had told her about Ab Snopes, and after that, we both knew it. It was like all three of us should have known it all the time. So you know Granny's going to die in this next section, because it's like, we told her not to, but you know how old ladies get. So the next, we learn of this group called Grumby's Independence.
Uh-oh.
And this is like 50 or 60, like, rogue former Confederates.
Oh, no.
Who are no longer attached to a regiment, are not fighting for the Confederacy, and are roaming the countryside, like, stealing, killing, just, like, pillaging.
Is this, like, proto-Klan stuff?
It is. I am going to take full advantage of the situation. It's not racially motivated. It's much more just, like, this is the only alpha I have left in me. Is just to, like, pick on people.
Okay.
And also, maybe I saw so much gratuitous violence in my time in the service that this is my new normal / I'm going to use this to my benefit.
Okay.
I've just really been deadened to
sure
violence and joy.
Okay. Good.
So, definitely someone you want to f*** with.
Yeah.
Seems like a cool group of dudes who are definitely doing the Lord's work, as we were just saying.
For my part, I love to find bands of roving, violent men and just pick fights with them.
They called themselves Grumby's Independence, about 50 or 60 of them that wore no uniform and came from nobody knew where as soon as the last Yankee regiment was out of the country, raiding smokehouses and stables and houses where they were sure there were no men, tearing up beds and floors and walls, frightening white women, and torturing Negroes to find where money or silver was hidden.
Gross.
Yeah.
It seems like a thing that often happens in armed conflict is that some people will just kind of
take advantage.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's weird. I had never thought that it would ever happen ever again. Because I don't think that history repeats itself or informs what happens today.
No, not at all.
And that's why I got my stupid degree in it.
Men will literally form roving bands of thieving murderers rather than go to therapy.
Oh. I think that they would actively choose it. They would be like, wait, it's a choice? Sign me up for that band.
You're like, wait, what was that first option again?
They were like, wait, I'm going to band practice. Roving band practice.
Roving murderous band practice.
Roving traitorous murderous band practice.
Roving murderous dad band.
I'll be back after I listen to my divorced dad bangers and rove the streets with my friends. What we do see here is that they say that this group's been caught once, and Grumby himself, terrible name, because all I could think about was Green Gumby, like on a horse murdering people.
That's a terrifying image.
Just like on top of Pokey, his horse, just raiding smokehouses, terrifying women and torturing people to find out where they hid their silver.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So Grumby was able to pull out this like tattered signed order he had from maybe the worst person in the Confederacy. Like, I don't know if it's like a fun game, but Nathan Bedford Forrest is definitely up there. Bow, 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 bow. Just like a true stain of a human being.
It's been many moons since I was immersed in Civil War history, but I seem to remember him being not just a real heel of a person, but objectively terrible at being a soldier as well.
Yeah, and also just like not like, oh, I killed someone at war, but like a true ass murderer.
Mm.
And also helped start the first arm of the Klan.
Right.
Yeah,
that guy.
So
piss on his grave.
There's that. Ab Snopes comes around, he's talking about these guys, and he's like, they have some thoroughbred horses, and we should go try to do to them what we've been doing to these Union soldiers. And that- write an order and sign it as Forrest and try to get this horses from them.
This
Which
seems
I'm
like...
sorry, but Granny, my gal, my good gal, you were doing the pseudo-lord's work. And you were really, like, doing okay. Like, why in God's name did you agree to this? This was like watching an episode of The Bachelor and just being like, ma'am, why? Ma'am. Ma'am. Yeah. Ma'am.
This seems like an objectively
terrible idea.
The worst idea. Just like, hey, there's these roving, racist, violent bands of men. I'm going to pull a petty con on them.
Well, Ab's like, we can get $2,000 for these horses. And we
you can get murdered is what you can get.
Well, spoiler alert. Yeah, this was a bummer because I was just like, oh, to have this character go out in this way too, I was just like, oh, totally avoidable. I like understand there's like some story building we got to do, but could we do it a different, could Ab just do this on his own? I don't know. Why do you need Granny? And it's because nope. You need like a soft white woman.
Faulkner needs you to know that
it's true.
Even Granny cannot resist.
And they do say they're like, Southern men would not harm a woman even if the letter failed to work.
Oh, that.
So they're really
I don't
like,
think that's true.
And the thing is, they're just like, oh, yes, he's a roving murderer. And yes, he terrifies women, but he wouldn't kill one.
He wouldn't kill old Grammy.
Oh, Gram. I'm sorry to say.
Gram's gonna get it, isn't she?
Yeah, and like in a really like unfortunate. And the story is mostly told from Bayard's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly first person, and it says, oh, we had no chance against him.
Uh-oh.
We begged her to let us ask advice from Uncle Buck McCaslin, anyone, any man. But she just sat there with that expression on her face, saying that the horses did not belong to him, that they had been stolen, and that all she had to do was frighten them with the order. And even Ringo and I, knowing at 15 that Grumby, or whoever he was a coward, and that you might frighten a brave man, but that nobody dared frighten a coward, and Granny sitting there without moving at all and saying, but the horses do not belong to them because they are stolen property. And we said, then they no more will belong to us. And Granny said, but they do not belong to them. So this is like a moral, like I'm on my moral high ground. You shouldn't steal. I make you pray when we lie, when we steal.
So she's deceiving herself as much as anything else.
Yes.
And they are relying on the inherent gentility of the white Southern man to keep her safe.
Which, like, why?
Well,
I mean, I'm
guessing Faulkner is about to teach us a lesson about the inherent gentility of the white Southern man.
Let me tell you that he's got a couple more lessons in his pocket.
Oh, I can't wait.
So they Ab is like, yes, we're doing this. And Granny's like, huck tooey, spit in my hand. We'll do this deal with the devil.
You mean one last heist?
This is Ocean's 13. This is the one with the ladies. Or no, is that Ocean? I don't know. There's a lot of them. Is Brad Pitt eating somewhere in this scene?
I don't. Is Brad Pitt about to get murdered?
Maybe. So they're going to find them at this abandoned cotton compress on the river. She makes this fake order. The boys are like getting more and more concerned on the ride. They're like, this is such a bad call. They get to these crossroads and Granny's like, I'm going alone from here. You can't come.
Oh, Grammy.
He says, you and Ringo look like men. They won't hurt a woman. Mm-hmm. And Bayard says, then you shan't go. I'm stronger than you are. I'll hold you. Because she's also like increasingly frail because she is an elderly woman. Yeah. She's too old to be conning.
Yeah.
Little Bayard's 15. He starts to cry and he's like, oh, here it is. I held her. Her arm felt little and light and dry as a stick. But it wasn't that. Her size and appearance had no more to do with it than it had in her dealings with the Yankees. She just turned and looked at me and then I began to cry.
And he's clearly having some kind of a premonition. He knows.
Oh, they both know. Him and Ringo both know. And she says, it's for all of us. Mm. So that we will have something when John comes back home. You never cried when you knew he was going into battle, did you? And now I am taking no risk. I am a woman. Even Yankees do not harm old women.
No.
You and Ringo stay here until I call you.
Uh-huh.
And he has this, like, lovely, sad little, like, about how she's like been the only adult in his life for most of his life because his dad's either been off working or has been at war
and now is on the run
and now is like on the run. And so they sit there. It says, we sat there in the wagon in the cold dissolving December twilight until at last I couldn't bear it any longer. And then him and Ringo start to run. They go into the woods and they find her and she's dead. There's no one. They've already gone.
Oh, no.
So they've just, like, killed her, and she's gone.
Grammy.
Yes. Like, she had been made out of a lot of little, thin, dry, light sticks notched together and braced with cord, and now the cord had broken, and all the little sticks had collapsed in a quiet heap on the floor, and somebody had spread a clean and faded calico dress over them.
Oh, no.
Yes. So Granny, their only real, like, adult is gone. And so now here comes vengeance again.
So they are just 15 and, like, jetting around on their own reconnaissance now.
Not quite. So they are going to go after Grumby and his independence.
Oh.
To avenge Granny.
Oh.
First, they bury her. Everyone comes out to this service in the rain. And they bury her. And they are going to be joined by this man, Uncle Buck, who is like a well-known dude in town, a friend of their dad's. He's significantly older than them. And he's going to kind of like go with them. And they spend the next 2 months following these dudes around Alabama and Mississippi trying to find them. And Ab Snopes has disappeared. And so they are assuming that Ab is also with Gumby riding Pokey off into the sunset. They are set upon one evening while they're sitting by the fire by this like very odd little man who's like wearing too nice of clothes, and he like doesn't really introduce himself but says he's looking for Grumby as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's sitting there. He gets up and is like, off I go. And he gets a little ways, gunshot. And he has shot Uncle Buck and, like, rides away.
Whoa, what?
So Uncle Buck now has a hole in his arm.
Why did he shoot Uncle Buck?
Because he is one of Grumby's independents. And he was, like, out scouting. Apparently, Grumby has gotten word that they are, like, being followed by these guys. Intrigue.
Why didn't he just kill all three of them?
It is wild. It's not really explained. He seems like this like weird cross between like a gentleman and not. They describe him as like this very tiny little petite man with tiny feet. And I don't know if it's supposed to be emasculating or...
He's a squirrely little guy.
Yeah. Anyway, Uncle Buck's the only one of them that has a gun either.
Okay.
He wears it on a string around his neck and tucks it into the front of his pants.
That's a good and safe way
to carry a firearm.
To carry a firearm. Yeah.
Right. That's how I carry mine.
That's what they always say when you go take firearm safety courses.
They say put it on a string around your neck and tuck it into the waist of your pants.
Mm-hmm. Pointed directly at your crotch.
Yeah.
If at all possible.
Yeah. Baby maker.
Yeah.
Boom.
Mm-hmm.
Bullet has gone straight through.
That's a good thing, isn't it?
It is. But Uncle Buck is like up in his years. Now has a hole in his arm.
Uh-huh.
And they describe like taking a piece of fabric from the bottom of his jacket and soaking it in salt water and then threading it through.
Oh no.
The bullet hole.
Oh no.
And like flossing.
Oh no. No.
Yep.
Absolutely not.
There's a flossing moment.
I dislike that strenuously.
We cut his sleeve away and stopped the blood, and he made me cut a strip off his shirt tail, and Ringo handed him his stick, and he sat there cussing us while we soaked the strip in hot salt water, and he held the arm himself with his good hand, cussing a steady streak, and made us run the strip back and forth through the hole the bullet had made.
Oh.
He cussed then, sure enough, looking a little like Granny looked, like all old people look like. And they have been hurt, with his beard jerking and his eyes snapping and his heels and the stick jabbing into the ground.
I mean, I guess, what is that, to get, like, detritus out of there?
I guess, and maybe, like, in some ways, like...
Sterilize
it?
I can't recommend it. I don't think that's how we should be.
No, when I think of things I want to do with my life... Rubbing a dirty, hot salt water strip of a jacket you've probably been wearing for 4 years through a straight through and through hole in your arm with no anesthesia is like on the list. It's not high on the list.
It does seem less than advisable.
Another point of Uncle Buck's is that he has like rheumatism because, again, he is like Granny's age. He's like an old man. And he is shot in the same arm that the rheumatism is in. And so he's like, ah, doubly painful. And Ringo tries to be like, well, at least it wasn't your other arm.
Your like, good arm.
Now it's like just like a doubly bad arm. And Ringo's trying to be nice. And Uncle Buck is like, big middle finger. Like, it, you just put a hot salt floss through my armhole. Get away from me.
It's like, I am not inclined to be optimistic about this.
Uncle Buck also does this thing, and maybe this is of the time, but I've never seen it before. But instead of saying, by God, he says, by Godfrey. And he exclaims it all the time.
That is delightful.
There it is, by Godfrey. There's the sign. Like, everything is by Godfrey. And is that like a friend's name for God? Like, my pal Godfrey?
I guess that's a way to avoid taking the Lord's name in vain.
I mean, I think it's that. It's kind of like how my dad used to say, God bless America, when he was mad, instead of, like, God damn it. He'd be like, God bless America. And so I feel like it's sort of the same thing. But Godfrey is, like, a man's
that's
name.
Just some dude's name.
And
yeah.
So I want to know who in Uncle Buck's life Godfrey is.
Just somewhere there's a Godfrey being like, you called?
Excuse me?
What?
Bayard lets us know, like, this is, the wound is getting to him.
Uncle Buck is not doing well. Okay.
He's not thriving. He's not 30, flirty, thriving. He is 80, wounded, and a bummer.
And having a bummer of a time.
Yeah, he's having a bummer of a time, but he's like, by Godfrey, I will find these men and kill him in your granny's honor. But they finally are like closing in on Grumby.
Ooh.
Grungy Grumby.
But with two teenagers, one wounded old man, and a gun on a string.
You've got it.
All right.
You're there.
Couldn't be going better.
Correct. They come across a dead snake. And this is where we get a by Godfrey. And Uncle Buck is like, it's a sign.
A sign of what?
that they're close and that some, like, so they go off in the woods in the direction of the snake and find who else but Ab Snopes tied up.
Oh.
Waiting for them.
Oh. See, there was a dead snake and then there was a tied up guy who was a snake.
Yeah.
I get it.
And it's funny that, and really lovely how poetic these roving murdering people are choosing to be. I love that for them.
I mean, if you're going to be roving and murdering, you throw a little symbolism in now and again.
Have some panache.
Yeah.
So they find Snopes tied up and they're like,
what up, buddy?
What are we going to do with you? And he's like, I didn't have anything to do with this. I'm so sorry. I made a bad call, but like, I didn't set her up. She made a decision. I'm so sorry.
I don't believe him.
And nor should you, because he's a dick. And now Granny's dead. He can't bring her back. But they don't kill him. They kind of like scuffle.
They're better than that.
But they don't kill him. And this will be a thing with Bayard of like not following in his other family members' footsteps of violent vengeance. And it is decided that Uncle Buck will take Ab back and the two 15-year-olds will keep going on their own towards the murdering rove, or the roving murderers.
Well, that's a decision.
It is, if you're just talking about binary decision making, it is a decision. And honestly, at this point, I don't think Uncle Buck is very helpful.
Uncle Buck's like, just go get murdered. I don't know. I'm tired.
We've got this, I got this rheumatism in my arm. And so he takes his neck string pistol and gives it to Bayard and is like, by Godfrey, catch them. By Godfrey. And so it says, so Ringo and I went on. I love that sometimes William Faulkner's like, I'm going to have a whole page that's one sentence. And sometimes it's just, so we went on.
And on we went.
And on we went. They come upon a old man's body with a note attached to it.
Oh, no.
Just what you want to find. Not ominous. There is a note. Last warning, not threat. Turn back. The bearer of this, my promise and guarantee. I have stood all I aim to stand, children or no children. And this is in like very poor, crude, like a child had written it.
Did you have to murder a guy to leave a note? Couldn't it just put a note on a tree, put a note on a mule? So just murdering some
for
innocent bystander.
Yes, for the purpose of threatening two children.
Good.
Cool.
That is a person whose life is going well.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is a second note, and it is written in very fine handwriting. And they immediately know that it is from this man with his neat little feet and his fine soiled shirt and his fine muddy coat across the fire from us that night.
Did he hold the pen with his fine little feet?
No, but apparently he has handwriting in a hand neat and small and prettier than Granny's. Only you knew that a man had written it. Which I'm like, how?
Wait. Is this man being queer coded? Is that what's happening here?
I don't know. It's not, you don't get enough from him character wise besides the tiny feet and the beautiful penmanship.
I'm just trying to figure out what Faulkner thinks tiny feet and beautiful penmanship denotes in a man.
I didn't even think about it because he doesn't come up besides in these two scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not odd for Faulkner to insert just like an insane amount of detail, even about a minor character that you're not ever going to deal with again. But it is an odd thing. I don't know if it's more to like give the contrast between his note basically is like, you know, up until now, we haven't been killing women and children, but like, don't try me.
Okay.
And so it turns out he's one of the dudes who's worse than Grumpy. And so I think it's more about the contrast between his like very gentlemanly appearance and like finer manners and finer clothing and the fact that he's actually worse than this like dumb guy who just is like taking advantage. He's like taking advantage of the person who's taking advantage of the situation.
So he's got like supervillain vibes.
Yes.
Okay.
And maybe there's something about supervillain and the tiny feet.
Maybe.
Who's to know?
Have we checked lately?
I will get right on that. I do own that Wikipedia page, so tiny-feeted villains. And so they're like, okay, here's this note, but we're still going.
Sure.
Because 15-year-old boys are...
When have you ever convinced a 15-year-old boy not to finish his vengeance quest?
Honestly, I feel like they would have... Like, if they had Jedi mind-tricked it, it might have worked better. But by being like, don't come near, they're like basically ensuring that they're coming.
100%, yeah.
So they are walking along and one of their mules, obviously we've got mules. Let's not be silly. There's obviously mules in this scene.
I'm beginning to think this novel is really about the mules at the end of the day.
Like I said, the unvanquished are the mule race. They will not be vanquished. Man steps out with his gun and is like, stay where you are. I'm watching you. Don't move. So they don't move. Out comes a couple other guys. And in between them on a horse is Grumpy. And he's got his like faded Confederate uniform, but he's wearing Yankee boots. He's got blood on his face. And then they realize his arms are tied behind him. So they're holding both them at gunpoint and him.
Oh.
So these guys have like usurped Grumpy himself.
There's been a mutiny.
Yes. And they're like, you want Grumpy, here he is. Like, if you'll just take him and like let us go and like leave us alone. As if these like two 15-year-olds and 80-year-old man have like scared these murderers into being like, oh, just take him and like we'll go.
It's because they know that their quest is righteous. At least that's the vibe I'm getting here.
I guess. I think their quest for like self-preservation and money and power, I guess. So depends on your narrative. But
no, I mean like the boys' quest is.
Oh, yes.
Like the vibe I'm getting from this is that even from Faulkner's perspective, that the boys are made more powerful by the fact that they are pursuing vengeance on Graham's behalf, which yes. makes them.
And we later find out that Grams is the first woman that they had killed in this whole time. Because they sort of make fun of Grumpy by being like, you've kind of been like brought low by the fact that you killed this woman.
Okay.
And he says, we had a good thing going in this country. We would have had it yet if it hadn't been for you. And now we've got to pull out, got to leave it because you lost your nerve and killed an old woman and then lost your nerve again and refused to cover the first mistake. Scruples, he said. Scruples. So afraid of raising the country that there ain't a man, woman, or child, black or white, in it that ain't on the watch for us. And all because you got scared and killed an old woman you never saw before. Not to get anything, not for one single Confed banknote, but because you got scared of a piece of paper on which someone had signed Bedford Forrest's name, and you with one exactly like it in your pocket now. And so he's been running around using this order from Bedford Forrest. And the fact that Granny came and had one too, he was like,
uh-huh.
Got scared, killed her, ruined the whole thing for everyone. And so they mutiny on him. So now they're like, have him. We don't want him. Like, we have to leave anyway. You've ruined this great murdering rove thing that we had going on. And like, you've ruined this because you had to kill this old lady because you got scared, you puss.
We had such a good homicidal thing going.
We were just like pillaging like mad, dude, and you got scared of a little old lady? Screw you. We're going to Texas. Where all good things happen.
It's true.
The two dudes leave. Grumpy leaps, tries to get the gun on the string.
Isn't Artis' hands tied behind his back?
Yes, but like he twists. There's a lot of whirling. There's a lot Ooh. Of twisting. And he's like coming for them. He's lunging at them. And they're scrappling.
A little bit of gun ballet.
We're scrappling.
Okay. Scrappling? And, like the breakfast meat?
Yep.
We're scrapping.
No, I would like to think of it like there's more to it than just scrapping.
Okay. We've got cornmeal. We've
yes,
got pork
we've
bits.
Got fat.
It's going into a frying pan. We are scrappling.
We're scrappling.
Okay, good.
Yes. Baird is like very much like, I don't know if I can, like, I don't know if I can kill this dude. While he's like also in the midst of this tussle, but he's like, this gun just like feels like heavy in my hand. But he eventually shoots him. They kill Grumpy.
Oh.
And they put him on a horse and they take his body home.
All right.
Yeah. So they take his body back to the same place he killed Granny and they hang his body up on like the wall.
Oh.
And they cut off his hand and they put his hand on Granny's grave and are like, she can rest easy now. She can truly be at rest because we've avenged her.
Wow. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're like, we're men. We have done it.
We did it. Give him a hand.
He only has one. They drop the hand off at Granny's grave and they get home. And who do they find? Dad's home.
Uh-oh.
Dad's home. War's over.
Wait, you mean that right after they finish the coming of age quest that makes them men by murdering the man who killed their grandmother and cutting his hand off and establishing themselves as the new scions of the South by becoming men?
Suddenly, we are in retreat. It's all but signed at Appomattox. And Father John is home again?
You mean that Daddy is home and now they're going to have to usurp him so that they can finish becoming men?
I wouldn't know. But I think you need to tune into next episode to find out.
I'm shocked. It's almost like 98% of literature is about daddies.
There's big daddy energy in this.
I can't wait.
Daddy energy takes a real twist, though. I will say it's not the traditional.
Oh.
Because Daddy comes home and Drusilla is with him.
Oh. Oh, well, now I'm really excited.
Yeah, I mean, it's... He throws a lot for a book where, like, very little happens in the first, like, four short stories. He throws a lot into the final three.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so... Sort of... Part one. What do we think? What do we feel? Where are we right now? Emotionally, existentially. What are our thoughts?
Mules.
Mules. So my, many mules.
My thoughts are mules. And my mules are thoughts. And no mules, just mules. This is a book that I actually really enjoyed rereading. I probably read it about 10 years ago. And there's not a ton written from a fiction perspective about wartime South, like home front. It's all either like Gone with the Wind type, like super overwrought,
mm-hmm.
or it's truly like a war, like it's a war piece. And so this, like, what's happening in the South at that time is, I think it's super interesting, and it's just, like, not something that a lot of people were talking about. I don't know. I'm excited to get to the end because it twists, like, two more times.
Ooh.
Before the end.
All right.
Yeah. How are we feeling? What is your, like, vibe?
I'm very intrigued to see where this goes. I'm already seeing some interesting, like, we are obviously playing with some very interesting thematic elements with coming of age and masculinity and Southern masculinity and Southern femininity and, you know.
Yes.
One of the things I'm very interested to see in part two and that I'm curious about in part one is in what we have read so far, you said it's narrated mostly by Baird. What is Ringo's, what's their dynamic like on the backdrop of all of this? I mean, we're going through all of these scenes that are very racially fraught, right? When we're rolling up on the Union lines and there are all of these people who are attempting to gain greater freedom and who are being spurned, you know, like literally stuck between a rock and a hard place between the plantations and the Union line who doesn't want them. To what extent, if any, is this being like editorialized, commented on?
That is the thing. It's like, this is a little bit about their relationship. This is like in the very first couple pages. All right. Ringo and I had been born in the same month and had both fed at the same breast and had slept together and eaten together for so long that Ringo called Granny Granny just like I did, until maybe he wasn't a Negro anymore or maybe I wasn't a white boy anymore. The two of us neither, not even people any longer. The two supreme, undefeated, like two moths, two feathers riding above a hurricane.
Oh.
Yeah. So, like, they're like kin
mm-hmm.
in a very real way. And we don't really get a whole lot of anything from Ringo or Bayard, really, about his feelings about it.
They're both parents from the 1990s who are like, I don't see color.
They are, but they're also, I think, both like 13-year-old boys.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some ways, I think that Faulkner like very conveniently picked characters who like are young enough as narrators that like, and as boys, I also think it just like maybe was easier to write them this way or easier to get away with not delving into it.
Yeah, it seems. And I'm always a big advocate of like characters are characters and people are people and characters are not people. But it does seem a little convenient for Faulkner that unlike any 13-year-old boy I've ever known, if they were transplanted into a hyper-racist society, that they wouldn't at some point at least be to each other about, or that Baird wouldn't be to Ringo about the difference in their social statuses. But maybe that's me being a cynic.
I think that it's giving Faulkner maybe more than I think he deserves.
Yeah, it's very convenient for Faulkner that this is how this pans out.
Right. I think he chose the things that he felt comfortable tapping at,
mm-hmm.
but he wasn't going to kick his foot through.
Sure.
He's still a man of Mississippi in the 1920s and 30s. Yeah. Like, do I think that he erred on a slightly more progressive line? Like, sure.
But that only gets you so far.
Do I think he's a progressive or a current? No.
Sure. Yeah.
But I do think he was more willing than a lot of people at the time to at least, like, bring some... Like, these are some stuff you wouldn't have even brought up.
Right.
Especially some of the stuff that comes with Drusilla in the latter half of the book.
Oh, I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really excited to see how this all develops. And thank you so much for being here with me today.
Oh my God. We're having so much fun.
We're having the best time.
Oh my God. I'm going to sleep like a mule tonight.
I am. I'm going to sleep on a mule tonight.
I mean, if I had 248 mules, I too would sleep on them. So
I'm definitely not going to spend the rest of today fighting with Instagram. Well, let's see. Maddie, is there anywhere that you would like people to find you if they can't get enough of this and want more?
You can find a lot of dog-related content for me on Instagram if you really want. It's at MadelineN9, all spelled out, like the number 9. And that's really it. I don't really have a... As a person who does social media for a living, I do very little social media for myself.
That's fair.
That is the balance of having to do it as your job. And I don't write or anything. I just hang out and read and listen to true crime podcasts. So if you want to hit me with a true crime, anything, hit your girl up.
All right. Send Maddie your favorite true crime recommendations.
Here and, for it.
Yeah. We'll see you.
We'll see you for part two.
Yeah. We'll see you for part two next week.
Hell yeah.
And thank you all again for being here with us. I can't wait to hopefully rejoin you in a week for part two of Faulkner's
The Unvanquished.
There we go. Could not remember the title there for a second. I mean, I am tired, y'all.
It is fair.
And as always, if you can, this week, this month, this pay period, consider supporting a living author, because they could sure use the love. Bye.
Bye.